This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Team 7 is the title of the debut novel by Marcus Burke. It tells the story of Andre Battle, a black kid growing up in Milton, Mass., just south of Boston. His Costa Rican mother works hard, does her best. His Jamaican father gets stoned a lot, has affairs, and is mostly absent.
Andre is a talented basketball player who grows away from his family and eventually falls into drug dealing with a local street gang. Team 7 is a powerful coming-of-age novel that draws on some autobiographical details.
Author Marcus Burke is the son of West Indian immigrants who grew up in Milton, and like his protagonist, he had a talent for basketball, which landed him a spot in a local prep school and eventually a college basketball scholarship.
But despite his ability on the hard court, Marcus Burke yearned for something else, to be a writer. But that meant overcoming a lot. His own lack of confidence, for one. Also, the expectations of his coaches, not to mention the pressure that society puts on a black kid from the city who can shoot hoops.
But a writer he is. And his first novel is called Team 7. And Marcus Burke, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really fun. And I got to say, I'm about 100 pages into this book, and it's wonderful. I'm taking a few days off next week, and I'm looking forward to bringing it with me. So
awesome.
Congratulations. So tell us a little bit about it. It's the story of Andre Battle, as we mentioned, a first-generation American growing up in Milton. Tell us a little bit about who Andre Battle is.
Well, Andre Battle is a first-generation American growing up in Milton, Massachusetts. He is West Indian. His parents are Costa Rican and Jamaican. He has a very complicated relationship with his father. He has a very complicated road to walk between straddling what he's been groomed to believe in the streets and what he's been raised to believe by a West Indian family that does not have the same moral compass that maybe the general, you know, Americans sometimes in the West Indian culture, you know, They seem to feel like you should stand aside and not, you know, join in the same way.
Yeah. And he's going through a bit of a difficult sort of adolescent struggle, identity struggle, really, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. How's that manifesting itself?
Well, the identity struggle is just your initial moral compass generally comes from those that you were raised around. And he was raised around his grandparents, who are old-school West Indians, and they don't understand the culture that he's becoming a part of.
I see.
And so when they catch glimpses of some of the things that he's involved in, it just completely boggles their mind, and he has to kind of decide where his loyalties lie and which road that he'd like to walk and who he'd like to be.
Tell us, Marcus, about the title, Team 7. What is Team 7 in the book?
Team 7 is a group of local guys that hang out on his block, and they deal some drugs. And they initially, they're called Squad 6.
Mm-hmm. And so he's the seventh.
He's the seventh member.
Right. Yeah.
And I think over time, The story started, I started writing it because there was a group of guys in my neighborhood called Team 7, but they weren't an official gang. There wasn't gun-toting. I mean, maybe some mild menacing, but they weren't that kind of entity. But I started writing it because I wondered why they always called themselves that.
Yeah.
And so when I wrote the story, I felt like I'd kind of solved the question a little bit. Like, well, he joins, and so now he's the seventh member. But that was the second story that I wrote for this entire project, or, you know, this entire novel. It was the second chapter that I wrote. And I would say that over time, as, you know, some of the religious things started to get involved, like the title to me gained more power.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a biblical sense, 7 is the number of completion. And I think he joins this group looking to try to complete something about himself or learn how to mature as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody must at some point walk that road for themselves.
Sure. Marcus, I'd love to get you to read a passage from the book. And I was thinking right at the start of chapter 6 on page 84, this sort of describes Andre's experience in middle school and what he's feeling. I wonder if you could just read the first couple of paragraphs there.
Sure. This is from the section Objects in Motion. It didn't take long to be identified as one of the troublemakers in the seventh grade. In just 1 week, I went from being a harmless wanderer to being a roaming troublemaker. My teachers in the sixth grade labeled me a hallway wanderer, and they stuck me in the resource room down in the basement, where they hide the special education department. The school told Ma that I needed extra attention, but I think they just didn't want me wandering the hallways like I do. I don't really need extra help, but the teacher, Miss Lenny, damn near be doing my homework for me. I still feel like the punishment didn't fit the crime, but I shouldn't complain. See, there's a big difference between being a wanderer and a troublemaker. Both stigmas raise teachers' eyebrows and neck hairs, but when you're a wanderer, they're still nice to you. They just want you to get to where you need to be. But when you're a troublemaker, you glow red in the eyes of the teachers. They straight up don't want you around. Once you're slapped with the troublemaker reputation, you're as good as being a criminal in the streets. And teachers police you like hallway cops, looking for a reason to accuse you of something. Whether it's a simple misunderstanding or not, if a teacher decides you're guilty of something, you hardly get a chance to defend yourself. Because talking back is rude once you've been accused.
That's Marcus Burke reading from his debut novel, Team 7. Marcus Burke grew up in Milton, Mass., went to school not far from here, Brimmer and May, and then on to Susquehanna University on a basketball scholarship. Marcus, a lot of questions in that passage really sort of capture what Andre is struggling with. And I'm wondering if you can describe a little bit. What's going on there? It's this sort of increasing feeling of alienation almost from his environment, it seems like.
Well, I think Andre and a lot of young men like Andre, I think they're labeled. Mm-hmm. And once you begin, you know, most people, I mean, in general, have a identity crisis. They're trying to figure out who they are. And once you start putting boxes and labels on people, you know, you're a bad kid or you're a good kid. Mm-hmm. That begins to start to dictate how you behave and if you accept that or not. And clearly in his house, one of the biggest things his mother tells him is he's cut above the rest, regardless of what's going on. And you know, when you're told in the street or you're told at school that you're a troublemaker, a bad kid, it begins to put you, it confuses you. And so there's a bunch of different ways you could take it. And I think that
This is a big theme in your life, isn't it? I mean, this idea of being put in a box, of being defined, of, you know, in your case, black kid from Milton, basketball player, scholarship. You had to sort of deal with being put in a box, right?
Absolutely. People put you in a box, and it's not, I won't say that being put in a box, I mean, people, you have to define people in some kind of way. Mm. But I think there are things that come along with being put in a box that I don't accept. Mm-hmm. As in, you know, I'm a black guy, so I can't do this. Or I'm a black writer, so I can't write about this subject matter. Or because I don't do this, I'm not this. And I think that going from the collective to the individual is important. And I wanted to not check for what society maybe was saying I should be doing and follow what I felt.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about this journey from sort of basketball, high school, scholar athlete, scholarship basketball player to writer. You wrote really eloquently in the Atlantic magazine, or I guess you were interviewed by Joe Fassler, and you were quoted just wonderfully eloquently, why every writer needs two educations.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What do you mean by that, two educations?
Well, I believe that everybody is indeed given an education, and it's just as good as a roll of the dice or a pick of the cards. You know, some people are born with parents that like them, or some people are born in really rough situations, and those things begin to dictate how you identify with yourself and your own sense of self. And at a certain point, you can no longer be victim to that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think at a certain point, you got to say, well, that happened, but I'm beginning to gain some agency. And so once you free yourself from some of those barriers that you put around yourself, for in my case, I was an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my confidence in the classroom had been grandly eroded by a series of troublesome teachers. And I had to...
That's a nice way to put it.
I had, at a certain point, I had to say, well, this is something that I can do. And even if they call me crazy, I believe in this. And
when you say this, this being a writer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, most people say to you, be pragmatic. This is something that is not going to work out. Look at the numbers. They're not in your favor. But those are people that aren't writers usually.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you say be pragmatic and this is something that's not going to work out, because in this essay in The Atlantic, you write, for me, the term student athlete was something of an oxymoron. I wasn't an NBA prospect or anything, but you couldn't really convince me that there wasn't going to be consequences to my lack of action. And then you say, when you get recruited, it puts you in a funny mind space. Coaches and colleges all calling and they want you, but it's really just setting you up for a fall.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even out of the small amount of high school players that begin to play college sports, maybe 1% or 2% of that small fraction are going to actually go pro in any regard. Right. We're not even talking about the NBA. And so most people are going to, the rubber's going to meet the road, and you're going to have to figure out, I must do something else, because you're now released to your own custody, really.
And yet that's not so easy. And in your case, it's a really interesting story, because you get to Susquehanna, you're on a basketball scholarship. Tell me how things start to go for you, first of all, academically.
Well, at Susquehanna, it's a Division III school, so they do financial packages. And opposed to a scholarship.
Right, right, right.
And so when I got to Susquehanna, I was recruited. I was a business major. And I didn't really think twice about it. They have a highly accredited business school. I just said, sure, you know, I'll do it. I get to play basketball. I get to leave and fine. And I got there, and I wasn't aware of the climate of central Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It's not the most hospitable for a young African-American man. And I wasn't... I just felt like I had found myself in a situation and I needed to understand how. And I did my case studies. I was like, who told me to do this? And why did I listen to them?
Mm-hmm.
And so moving forward, I decided I was going to listen to myself. And that put me grandly at odds with the people that, or, you know, the people that sent me there. But always having a supportive family has been my saving grace.
Mm.
Even when... You know, coaches turned their back on me and, you know, said all kinds of terrible things to me that they probably regret. My mother never once doubted me. My mother, even when, you know, those people called her and said, we're sending him home, she said, send him. Love to have him. You know? And so that was always one of the things that charged my back up, was just that my mother never tried to put boxes on us. She said, anything you want to do, just do it well. And...
That's great advice. That's great advice from a parent. But, I mean, go back to a little bit to what you said about what, for example, your coaches told you when you made it clear that you wanted to be a writer. I mean, what kind of things did they say to you?
Well, the coach that I was dealing with at the time was a big money guy. And so he couldn't really understand why I wanted to write. And he was like, what do you... He thought it was all that I had a girlfriend or something at home. He just couldn't understand. And he was saying, like, you know, I looked at this statistic sheet and writers make the least money next to waiters and you're going to be an alcoholic and all this other stuff. And at that point, I realized that even though this was the guy that recruited me to go to private school and all that stuff, and, you know, we were now dealing with college level things, just because somebody believed in you once doesn't mean they'll always believe in you.
Mm.
And
or they're not necessarily going to follow you through the change that you're going through, right?
Yeah. And I had to just step back and say, well, fine, you know, because I didn't want to have to legitimize what I was doing while I was trying to figure out what I was doing.
Yeah.
And so it was easier for me to go my own way and to have that quiet time rather than to be antagonized the entire time that I was trying to accomplish something.
Yeah. Boy, I mean, it sounds like, though, this journey, I mean, talk about being all of us being put in a box and all of us being defined in a certain way. It seemed like this was the moment in your life where you really had to break out of that box.
Yeah. There was the first summer in college that I stayed home in Boston. Mm-hmm. And I got a job at Brookstone. I was the assistant manager. And I remember that summer I worked the night shift, so it was quiet. And I read On Becoming a Novelist. And that was also the summer that I saved up the money to buy a computer because I had to get a single because I wanted to write from like on my own in my room. And that was, it was grandly freeing because at that point, you know, I was playing basketball, it was almost more of a force of habit. I'd fallen in and out of love with basketball a million times. And writing was really what was preserving me, but I wasn't ready to outwardly claim or identify as a writer. Mm-hmm. I still felt like this is just this quiet little thing that I'd enjoy doing when things get too crazy. And then it started to, I felt like writing started to call toward me where I was in writing class, a fiction class, and, you know, my professor would read my work aloud. And coming from being socialized as a troublemaker or something, I was like, is this guy picking on me or something? You know, and
why is he reading my stuff?
Yeah, I was like, he keeps calling on me. And I wasn't used to somebody being encouraging in that way, where they were like, actually, I think that there's something here and you should really go after it. And so
where did that encouragement first happen?
The first time was I was in my intro to fiction class taught by Tom Bailey. And
now, wait, where are we? We're talking about...
This is sophomore year of college. I just became a creative writing major because I had to do something other than business. And we our first assignment was to write a first-person narrative. So the first section of this novel, it was a section called The Big One, Too. And that was really, like, the first short story I had ever completed. And it grew because I just didn't feel done with the characters. But my professor, see, my classmates in Central Pennsylvania, they were not very receptive. They were like, nope, we don't believe you. Nobody lives this way. And my professor, he had a whole different idea. And he was just kind of like, don't listen to that. Like, this is good. Mm-hmm. And we can work on all that other stuff. And, you know, he really stuck with me. And that was instrumental. You know, having somebody on campus and having a great team at home, it made me then feel like I probably should have felt initially with the basketball program.
Yeah.
Which is that, like, I was inside of a program that had my back wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. And the basketball program at Susquehanna did have my back. I can't say that they didn't. But it took us a while to find peace, I'd say.
We should say that you were accepted into the Iowa's Writers Workshop, and that's one of the oldest and one of the most prestigious MFA writing programs in the country. How did that experience shape your writing?
I always say that Iowa, like, made a man of me. I got to Iowa, and I was very young, and I had this idea that it was going to be like this, like, boot camp of writing, that I was going to have, like, millions of pages to read and all this stuff. And I feel like I always say to my sister or whoever that, like, one of my Welcome to Iowa moments was I was a full fellow in my first year. And like I said, I'd had some freshman year sins as an undergrad. So I just came off of doing 52 credits as a senior to graduate. And then I was a full fellow at the Writers Workshop. So I signed up and I got there, and then I, you know, went to the intro thing, and I called because I didn't have anything to do. And I was like, is there anything to do? And I remember I was talking to Connie Brothers, and she was like, well, did you set up your direct deposit? I was like, yeah. She was like, go read a book, go write. And I was like, that's it? Like, I was like, go write. And it was really overwhelming at first because I'd never, writing was always something that I ran to when things got crazy. It had never been pushed that much to the forefront that it was like, no, this is what we want you to do all the time.
Yeah.
And that was when I had the time and the space to really develop an aesthetic and to figure out, like, what do I even like to read? What do I even think is good for myself? Because everybody can, you hear the heralded writers all the time, the big names, but that doesn't mean anything if you don't understand why. You know, you can watch all the great NBA players and you can understand, like, oh, he's good or that, but if you don't read a book, you won't really understand its merit for yourself to say, oh, this is awesome. Mm. And so when I got to the workshop, that was something that I really enjoyed.
Marcus Burke, I'm really curious to sort of bring this back to your roots here in Boston. You just gave a talk to students at your alma mater, Brimmer and May in Chestnut Hill.
Yeah.
I'm curious what advice you gave your the folks at Brimmer. What do you want your teenage self to know?
I think the best, I don't know, I think listen to yourself. And that's not always an easy thing to do, but you must. And I feel like if you keep a good team around you, people that will support you in the decisions that you're making because they're coming from your heart, then you should chase that, because if it's a passion, then it doesn't feel like work. And it's easy to lend yourself to putting in 8 or 9 hours in your office, or, you know, reading for an entire day. I just think you must follow whatever that passion is, because being different is not easy at that age.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to necessarily stick out for any reason, but you have to separate yourself if you want to be an individual. And at the end of the day, everybody has to have a career for themselves. There's no, like, me and my buddies do all of this stuff together. So that's kind of what I think the best thing would be, just get in tune with what you really want and stay close to your vision. It takes a lot of faith.
All right. Well, Marcus Burke, you've certainly done that. It's a wonderful book. It's called Team 7. It's Marcus Burke's debut novel. Marcus Burke, thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations on Team 7, and thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Marcus Burke's debut novel is Team 7. He's speaking tonight at the Harvard Coop. A lot more information on our website, radioboston.org.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.